Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rapport. This week, we have on Kwame Onwuachi, the chef of Kith and Kin in Washington, D.C., as well as two fast casual joints, Philly Wing Fry. He is the author of the recently published book, Notes from a Young Black Chef, which I actually read. And I say actually because I have no attention span and I can't finish anything. But this memoir, it's a really, really good book. It's about Kwame's growing up in the Bronx, his move to Nigeria as a young kid, coming back, trials and tribulations after that. And eventually sort of rising to success as a chef. But it's a book much more about just growing up than it is about being a chef in a lot of ways, and I highly recommend it. Today we talk about his story and how he wrote this book. All right, let's do this. Kwame Onwuachi, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me. I'm very, very, very excited to be here.
We got three varies. I like it. Very excited. Okay, so I'm just going to put you on the spot right out of the gate, all right?
Okay.
You're from New York. You got friends, family here, former colleagues here. Everyone mm-hmm. wants a piece of you right now. Where'd you eat last night?
Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Philadelphia.
Oh, you were in Philly last night?
Yeah.
Oh, you weren't even in New York last night?
You want to know where I ate in New York?
Yeah.
I ate at Fish Cheeks 30 minutes ago.
Oh, 30 minutes ago en route.
It was delicious.
It was what you have.
I had their whole steamed fish.
Ooh, so nice.
Have you been to Fish
Cheeks? I have not, no, no.
It's my favorite restaurant in the country right now.
So, really? Why?
Yeah. It's food that really reminds me of being in Thailand, mm-hmm. which is, as you know, hard to find.
Yeah.
Like that true authentic. Yeah. And, you know, they take really, really good care of their food. They cook with love, and you can taste it. So there's a whole steamed black bass, and it's in this, like, ginger and lime broth, mm. and it comes, like, in this like miniature little chafing dish to the table. So it's like bubbling, has like the flames mm-hmm. underneath it, and it's still simmering as you're eating it. And then there was a coconut crab curry. There was a crab fried rice, shrimp. I'm gonna destroy the name, yeah. but it was a shrimp salad with like a coconut fish sauce on it. It was out of this world.
That sounds amazing.
So good.
So when you go out to eat like at a restaurant like this, how often are you just, I'm just going to enjoy a meal or I'm just going to eat? And how often are you sort of taking mental notes and be like, ooh, this might be something I want to riff on?
Always. I wouldn't say riff on, but you take like certain elements, you know?
Like from this meal, what did you come away with? Like, oh, I should think about doing
it. It doesn't come like, I'm going to take this idea and steal it. It usually comes in like your creative process when you're creating a dish. It's like, oh, I remember this fish that I had in this broth, so I'm gonna do my version of this in a broth.
Exactly.
You know,
and your broth might be completely different.
Exactly.
But you were inspired. It sort of got you thinking.
Exactly. And that's really where it comes into play.
Okay, so book's out. You've got an enormous amount of press coverage, good vibes from the book. Just came out a few days ago. When you wrote it, mm-hmm. what were you expecting the reception to be, and what were you hoping the reception to be?
I honestly had no idea. I think a lot of times with yourself, you're always like, who cares about my story?
Yeah.
You know, like, why is my story so interesting? And it was that I had to battle with myself and say, like, no, everyone's story is meant to be heard, or everyone has a story.
And I imagine it's tough for you when you've told the story so many times in your head, you're like, oh my God, is this even interesting anymore?
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Do people even care?
And then I, you know, my story was an elevator pitch, you know, talking to in front of guests or investors or whatever. So like this time it was the full story, the
okay,
good
so
and
the
bad.
Extended version. So you were used to sort of giving your spiel to, hey, get someone
romantic,
to invest in you.
It was just romantic, you know, yeah, I sold candy on the subway and then I did this and then I did that.
People are like, no way.
Yeah, but now it's like, no, I had to sell candy on the subway because of this.
Yeah, and you had to turn this into 220 pages.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was a therapeutic, very therapeutic process, putting your life story.
All right, so
pages.
I guess thank you for coming on the pod, because I don't mean this as a backhanded compliment. I mean this as a compliment. You got me to read and finish the book. I am like one of those guys who my 11-year-old has a better attention span than
really?
Me right now. I'm just like between the iPhone and YouTube and podcasts and my job, I just can't commit.
That's
you
a
know?
Huge compliment. Thank
so,
you.
Yeah, so I read it start to finish. And I'm like, I finished it, and I'm like, I want a medal.
How long did it take you?
Not that long, because like it's always one of those things. It's not about, it's when you can find the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, when do I have a long subway ride where I can sort of get into it, or a certain time at night if like my wife's out and my kid's asleep. I can spend some time with it.
I encourage people that are listening that are like you know, my dear friend here,
yes.
To listen to the audiobook.
Oh, yeah.
I narrated it myself.
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
So it's full of energy.
My wife just was doing the Beastie Boys book, which came out last year, which is like a 9-hour version. And I thought what was interesting about that book, you know, they got all these stories about how they kind of came to be and whatnot, and each chapter is narrated by a different sort of interesting, you know, person, whether in the hip-hop world or rock world
really?
Or, you know, an actor or whatever.
Okay.
So that was kind of a cool treatment of that. But the audio thing, especially nowadays, but you're so used to listening to podcasts or maybe you're driving, it's, mm-hmm. it's a cool way to sort of absorb.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of questions.
Okay. So I'm just going to start firing them away.
Yeah, you know, so the title of the book, Notes from a Young Black Chef.
Mm-hmm.
So much of the book was not even about being a chef. It was obviously the road that led you to there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you would have had this book in you, say you had gone on to become doctor, lawyer, whatever, one of these sort of professions? It feels like that your life story still would have sort of warranted in your mind a story to tell.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, I think this is where I'm at right now, you know, in my career.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, if I'm going to be candid, I've always wanted to not pigeonhole myself as like a black chef. I wanted to be remembered as a chef, you know.
But the title on the cover is
exactly.
"Notes from a Young Black Chef"
because that's where I'm at.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm constantly reminded of it every single day, whether it's by the delivery guy, whether it's.
you have that story in the book where the delivery guy comes in the kitchen looking for someone to sign, looking for the chef to sign.
Yeah.
And he walks right by you,
exactly,
because he just assumes you're not the boss.
Exactly, and I am a black chef. I cook, you know, my food.
Yeah.
You know, which I am. Somewhat defined by. So I think it doesn't matter what path I took. I think you're right. I have a story to tell. But since I am heavily into this industry, this is the story that I'm telling.
What made you feel like I need to get this out now? I need to tell this story now, as opposed to like, you know what? Maybe when I get to that level of Eric Repair or Daniel Blue and I'm 20 years in the biz and I've got 3-4 restaurants and everyone knows me. That's the time to write a book. But you said, no, you obviously felt like you needed to get this out in some way.
Well, tomorrow isn't promised today, right?
Okay,
so
there
like,
you go.
I'm not going to look into the 20-year down the road. Mm-hmm. I've seen people pass away at young ages. So it's not about, I'm just walking in my purpose right now. I was afforded the opportunity. I didn't like seek out publishers and I was just telling my story one day on stage at the Bitten Conference, mm-hmm. very close to here. What was it, like 3 years ago, and there was a literary agent in the crowd, and she was like, "You should have a book," and I was like, "All right, let's do it." You know, I was just like,
"Had that occurred to you before
to write a book?"
Yeah,
I mean, I thought my story was interesting. You know, I traveled around the country and did pop ups, and before the dinners, I would lengthen the story based on how intricate my first course was because they needed time to play it up. So I would tell a 20-minute anecdote or a 5-minute one, you know?
Yeah.
And I got good at it. So, you know, I got an opportunity, you know, and where I'm from, opportunities, you know, you have to make them. And when they do come along, you're either prepared for them and you can execute them or, you know, you let it go by and I put my head down and wrote my own proposal and shopped it around.
Yeah.
And it worked out.
How much, you know, looking at the title, Notes from a Young Black Chef, there's obviously a long sort of storied history in this country of from Richard Wright to James Baldwin, et cetera, down the road, you know, Ralph Ellison, of like what it's like to be a black man grown up in America.
Mm-hmm.
And how much of when writing this book was in your mind, like, yeah, I would like to enter that pantheon. I want to be among those, you know, those giants, you know, as opposed to just writing a book about the restaurant industry.
Exactly. Well, you know, it started as that. It started as, you know, being honest again, it was called Chasing Happiness.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the proposal was titled. And it was this like very simple linear story. And, you know, to your point, I'm young. I'm still living my life as I'm writing it.
Yeah.
You know, the book was supposed to come out before, soon after the Shaw Bijou opened up, and it closed, and that changed the whole narrative of the book.
Yeah. So you signed the deal before that restaurant was even.
It was before everything.
Yeah. So you were still very much a young chef at that point.
Very young.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You weren't even a head chef at that point.
No, I wasn't.
All right. So that's what's interesting about the book. So for those of you who have not read the book, tell us Kwame's story from young childhood in the Bronx, into Nigeria, back to the Bronx, college, which is a whole other, not the typical college experience, I would say.
not for many.
No, it seems like a common thread
throughout the book, from being a young kid into sort of getting your first jobs in catering or in restaurants, is having a lot of bravado, a lot of hustle, if you will, maybe telling some half-truths to get in the door, but then once you're in the door, working your ass off to back up the bravado.
Exactly, yeah.
And like, where did that come from?
It came from my mom, watching my mom.
All right, so yeah, let's talk about your mom for a bit and her influence on you and what it was about her that sort of made you you.
Yeah, my mom, you know, she inspires me for a lot of things, for a lot of reasons, you know, mainly her ambition and her,
she's resilient.
Her hustle. Just resilient. Like, you know?
It seems like she's the type of person who was not going to quit. And you made that point when you visited some other friends who's like, you know, she's not going to take any assistance. She's not going to take any support, whether welfare or otherwise. Like, she's going to make her living.
She's going to make it happen.
And it's going to be on her.
Yeah. So that's where I get my drive, you know, watching her. You know, anytime I thought I had it bad, like where I was like doing my catering or selling some candy on the subway, I was like, my mom was surviving in the 90s with two kids alone. And working as a chef.
And you were literally sleeping in a closet in your apartment.
Yes, yes. So I hats off to her. You know, she inspires me still to this day.
So I want to talk about how tough she was, because in the beginning of the book, you talk about it when you're a little kid, like you were, you know, stapled to her side while she's cooking. And she's like, and she's originally, her family goes back to Louisiana and Texas and making a lot of the food of that region. And you're just sort of drawn into the kitchen. But then, as you got a little bit older, and I have a certain 11-year-old son who makes me, I was thinking about him when I was reading this book, like you started getting some old ideas in your head, and you started kind of being your own man, even though you were 9 years old. And she's like, all right, Kwame, we're sending you to Nigeria to live with your grandfather on your dad's side. And you're like, wait, what?
And yeah.
As a parent, it's I get it, because kids can be the most, as much as you love them, they can frustrate the hell out of you. But that was a power move by her. She's like, you know what? I need to do what's good for you. And you might not recognize it at the time.
For sure.
How long after she sent you to Nigeria, and you can talk about how long you were there for, did you resent that for years afterwards?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I knew I was a piece of shit kid. I was like a bad kid, you know?
A lot of attitude and talk back.
A lot of attitude, talk back, you know, come home when I want to. Like, this is at a young age. And you know, it's hard for parents, especially in the South Bronx, you know, or in the Bronx. Like, that's an easy path that you can see your child going down. And kudos to her for, like, it was tough as a parent to send me away, but would she rather send me away to prison or in a body bag?
Yeah.
Or send me to Nigeria for a couple years to get my stuff together?
Well, it was really tough. There's one scene in the book that's very poignant. You go there for the summer, and you're like, okay, cool. I'm going to go visit my grandfather or cousins and whatnot, hang out in Nigeria. And then you call her, like, all right, Mom, I'm ready to come home. And she's like, you're not coming home.
Yeah. Yeah, just staying there until you learn respect. And that was 2 years.
I imagine you must have remembered that moment, like, crystal clear for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I dropped the phone immediately. Like, I couldn't believe it.
You were, like, 9 at that point? 10?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were in an internet cafe, like a dusty internet cafe in the middle of Nigeria. And I just dropped the phone, got back in the car, and we left. And I had to settle into my reality.
And you had no idea when you were going to go back at that point?
No, I had zero idea.
Yeah.
Zero idea. That's when I fell in love with Harry Potter, though. Because I had the Harry Potter books there to keep me company.
Well, it's interesting, but then you managed to turn that sort of trying time into a positive. And once I thought one theme that sort of recurs to your book is that you talk about ultimately going to school in Nigeria and how sort of respect begets respect, and what it was like to be treated by teachers in Nigeria compared to some of your teachers in the South Bronx, and how they looked at you as just like, oh, Kwame, that kid's trouble.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
We were all just kids in Nigeria. You know, we weren't black kids. We were just kids.
And
there wasn't that, like, divide.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you're the troublemaker.
There's no troublemaker. Yeah. Like, there's a troublemaker that's a kid that's causing a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And there wasn't that, like, bias.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I feel like that subject then, or theme, resurfaces later on in the book when you start working in professional kitchens, like when you get to 11 Madison Park and the first Chef de Cuisine is a guy that you really liked and respect, and he respected you, mm-hmm. and it's very synergistic, and then a new guy takes over, and all of a sudden the tone completely changes.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, you're the same person doing the same work, but now you're, like, getting the side eye or whatever,
yeah.
or getting yelled
and
at.
Having to prove myself once again, or, yeah.
It's interesting when you read those sort of things about a professional kitchen, you're like, well, it doesn't seem like a professional kitchen has to be this way because we were just working for someone who made a completely different tone.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the thing, you know, with what I'm trying to break down and trying to make people realize that, like, yes, you know, there are great people that come out of abuse. There's also great people who came from nurturing.
Yeah.
And massaging those talents instead yeah. of, you know, beating them out of someone, you know?
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, this has obviously been written about a lot in the last year since the Me Too movement about restaurant kitchens and the restaurant industry, and it comes from this world of, you know, I remember reading Eric Ripera's memoir, 32 Yolks, and just talking about working in restaurants, Michelin-starred restaurants in Paris, you know, mm-hmm. 80s and 70s, and just getting berated and screamed at, and there's this culture of, like, we have to beat you down.
And then build you back
yeah.
up.
But do you need to, though?
Like, no, you don't. You can get a lot more out of people for having an emotional connection to them.
So, yeah, so how do you run things at Kith and Kin then? Like, how do you, what sort of culture do you sort of institute based on what you, your time at Per Se or your time at EMP? Where, like, you know what? That's not what I want
to
do.
Well, I try to get to know my cooks on a personal level, you know, get to know what's going on. It's the same structure that you have in any other professional environment, you know, Your supervisor tries to get to know you.
Yeah.
Tries to know when your birthday is or when your significant other birthday is or how old your children are so you can have this rapport.
Yeah.
So that way when someone comes in and they're not performing their best, I don't take it as personally that they're attacking me. It's like, what's going on? Are you okay? Let's go for a walk.
Yeah.
Let's go and talk. Hey, I'm Kwame right now. It's not Chef. It's like, it's me and you. Let's just talk on a personal level. And I can get what's wrong with my cooks from that, because people. I mean, we have a life outside of the kitchen, you know, and it's not life or death, you know. We are there to create great experiences for people, but we have to take care of the people that are then put in charge of creating great experiences for
yeah.
people.
But it's tough because there's that schism of, hey, you're a human being, you've got to. Significant other, you've got whatever problems at home, mm-hmm. I'm here for you. But then also, you also talk about in the opening scene in the book, you're doing a catering, high-end catering gig at the African-American History Museum, Smithsonian, D.C. And it's like, if everyone isn't firing on all cylinders, that whole production goes off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
And there needs to be a sense of discipline.
Absolutely.
And like, you need to be, everyone needs to be in lockstep. So then how do you enforce that while also still being an empathetic guy?
So with that being said, you're getting the best out of people because mm-hmm. not everyone's going to come in and fire in on all cylinders every single day.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get someone to do that. The reason why a lot of us chefs are in this position is because we do that day in and day out. No matter what's going on in our personal life, we put that aside. We put our heads down. We'll come in if somebody calls out. We'll stay late. We'll open. We'll close. We'll do whatever it takes. But we can't expect that from everyone that's yeah. working with us. So what you need to do is you need to empathize with these people that are working for you, find out what's going on, and then try to bring them back out of that.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I have a guy on hot apps, you know, sometimes in my restaurant, he's in his head for various reasons, things that are going on at home. But I know what's going on because I talk to him.
Yes.
So I'm like,
so you have
hey,
you
man,
have a sense like, hey, I get it. Let's refocus. We talk about that after
yeah,
the shift.
Like, you know, is this person in your family okay? Like, how's everything going?
Yeah.
You heard bad news today. I'm so sorry, but listen,
we got 200
this.
Covers out there
we got
right
200
now.
200 covers. Yeah. I need you tonight. Let's just get through this. Maybe you can go home a little bit early, or step out and call them if you need to. But it's almost 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Like, let's get our stations together. And then it's like, you know, and there's this, yeah. this form of camaraderie between us because there's.
You just said it's interesting. I always like, you never trust like a person in charge who says I all the time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He's like, well, I did this and I did that. And you're like, actually, it's, yeah, technically, but it is the we.
It's we.
You know?
It's we. I meant we, like, yes.
No, I know. Oh, you said we as in chef. Oh, yeah, we chef. But yeah, I also mean we as in,
but
like,
no, we have to go into service.
Because, like, yeah, if the team isn't together, the service doesn't work. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter how talented Kwame
no,
is.
It doesn't matter. You know? If Garmage goes down, the kitchen goes down. It yeah. doesn't matter if roast goes down. Garmage goes down, kitchen goes down. Same as the dishwasher goes down, kitchen goes down. So we're a team together. You know, I bring the dishwashers into pre-shift, and we have pre-shift together, and we all talk together. You know, it's really, really important.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right. So you're in this great place now. You got nominated for a James Beard Foundation Award.
Mm-hmm.
Just got a Food and Wine Best New Chef. You got this book that's getting tons of heat. So, but you had a rough upbringing. Talk about dealing drugs when you're in college, abusive father, all this stuff that your mom working her ass off just to make ends meet, trying to make ends meet. And it was interesting. You talk about one time about having, you know, just there were days of just like sandwiches and white bread and like barely enough to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often wondered this with chefs, and the opening scene in the book, you're also talking about making this very refined interpretation of gumbo, and you're spooning the caviar on there, and you've mm-hmm. got the lobster talk and everything. Do you ever reconcile with that? Like, oh man, like there's a lot of people who can barely eat others. There's so much tough, but then I'm going to do this very luxurious dish.
Mm-hmm.
And how do your mind, do you sort of reconcile the two?
I mean, I give back in other ways.
Yeah.
You know, I got to make a living.
Yes.
So, you know, it doesn't matter if you're living below the poverty line, but you work at General Motors putting a tire on a car that you can never afford. It's very similar, you know,
yeah.
In that regard. I have a job to do, you know, and this is what I feel that I'm good at. So that's how I make my living. But you can use this platform to instill change. You know, you can use this platform to raise funds for people that wouldn't even want to eat this gumbo with caviar. They just want to eat regular gumbo, or they don't even eat gumbo.
But you also use it as in that charity event, you also use it as an opportunity to tell your story and give these people some background about what they're eating and why and how this dish came to be.
Exactly.
Even though it's a very much more sort of elevated version of the original, but there is an original.
It's original, and there, you know, there's a story behind it, but also these people are going to get this food from somebody, so like I'd rather sell it to them than the next guy.
Talk about in the book another thing which you talk about a lot was your ability to kind of cross borders,
mm-hmm.
to go from uptown to downtown, from sort of cultured, interesting get-togethers. You talk about Spike Lee and other people you met when you were a little kid,
mm-hmm.
to hanging out with kids in the projects in the Bronx. At what point did you kind of recognize that you might be a little bit different than a lot of the kids you were growing up with?
Well, I had different experiences. I had spent time in Africa. You know, the kids in the Bronx did not spend time in Africa. You know, I had traveled to Louisiana, you know, to Beaumont, Texas, you know, for my family reunions. You know, a lot of them haven't really even left that area. So, like, I knew experience-wise, I had different experiences than the kids that I surrounded myself with. And also I can move from uptown to downtown, and I knew my way around. So like, just from my experiences alone, I knew that I was different, but inherently different. I mean, I thought we were all the same.
Yeah.
You know, like I still talk to my friends back home and I'm like, you know, you can do this. You can be where I am. You know, I still think everyone has something in them to do more than what they're doing.
Absolutely. In terms of getting started cooking, you cooked for your first kind of real, like, hardcore kitchen job was working in the Gulf of Mexico after the oil spill, and they were cleaning up the Gulf.
Yeah.
Talk about that, because that strikes me as insane, the fact that you kind of talked your way into this gig, and you're like, you knew you were going to get paid well.
Yeah, we were paid handsomely, but I had no idea what I was doing, you know, and my mother even warned me. She's like, this is going to make or break you, you know. You don't have a cell phone to, like, look up recipes. Like, you're just out there cooking for these people.
On a ship in a little galley
kitchen. This is all they do three things a day. They work, they sleep, and they eat. That's it. So I was a third of their focal point of the day. And I just cooked. I just mimicked my mom. You know, I cooked
with
love.
But you had to get that point. You originally, the chef there, this guy Tex you talk about, was kind of like, he's going to do his thing, and you were there to help him. And at some point, you're like, well, let me get a shot.
Well, yeah, I walked in. The guy asked me if I knew how to read. Yeah. And started using terms like you people. Yeah. I get a lot of you people that don't know how to read. And I was like, you know what?
Yeah.
I tried to work with him. And it didn't work out, so I was like, you just cook your food, I'll cook my food. And that's how I became the head chef, quote-unquote, on the boat. After they tasted my food side-by-side with Tex, they were just
But at that point, how much actual restaurant cooking had you? Had you done any restaurant cooking at that point? Not really.
I had done, in Louisiana, I mean, I couldn't get into every single thing I did in the book.
Yeah.
But I worked in like five restaurants
in
Louisiana.
So you had some, okay.
Yeah, I knew how to work with fire, I knew how to work the line. But preparing, ordering on my own, meal planning, you know, all of that was very new to me. I just was putting my head down, making Mexican, I worked at a Mexican restaurant in Louisiana. I worked at like a fried fish place. I worked at my mom's hotel, so she was the chef of a hotel in Baton Rouge. I mean, I worked in restaurants, but nothing to that extent. I mean, I had to order.
I was running a business.
I mean, I couldn't. We weren't like.
And how old were you?
Weren't like in Philly. Like we could get a truck pull up to the back of the boat every day.
Wait, so how old were you at this point?
I was 19.
That's insane.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And then
it was a crazy experience.
It was also, you talk about how food also connects people. And you looked at all these guys working there who you thought you probably had nothing at all in common with.
No.
And they were going to look at you like, who's this kid?
Yeah. I was terrified on that boat with these guys.
What were they like? How would you describe them?
I mean, like toothless white guys from the back roads of Louisiana. Like, I was afraid. I was the only black guy on there, and we were stuck on this boat.
You were a guy from New York with nice shoes.
With nice shoes and tattoos. Yeah. And I walk on, and I already thought these guys were racist, but then this guy asked me if I know how to read.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, my God, what am I doing? You know, I can't even leave. You know, I'm on this boat for 3 weeks.
So then how did you make that initial connection with the workers? Like, what did you serve them, and when did all of a sudden?
I made them shrimp etouffee.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, I said, I'm going to make shrimp etouffee. I said it to Tex or something. I guess he said it to the crew, like, yeah, he's going to make shrimp etouffee.
So good luck with that. Yeah.
So then the whole crew, it started like a conversation, and there was murmurings about it, like, yeah, we'll see, you know. And I started in the morning. I started making my shrimp. I was peeling all the shrimp, cutting all the vegetables. I started making my shrimp stock, reducing that down. You know, then I made my house spice, you know, my mother's house spice recipe. So it's like our Cajun spice, essentially.
So you couldn't even text your mom if you had a question at this point?
No.
Oh, you're on. It's like when you're on Top Chef. Like, yeah, exactly. You just got to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was, I don't know, 10 years ago? So, like, the boats weren't that advanced with cell phones, you know. So I started making this all from scratch. And you can smell like the depth of flavor on the boat at this point in time. So by the time like 6 o'clock hit
like and the galley
like gate opens up and I'm serving the shrimp etouffee, the whole galley went silent. They were eating and they came to me and was just like, all right, man. What they were like, what's for lunch tomorrow? And then that's how the conversation opened up.
How long did you stay on the boat for?
The entirety of, until it was like 2 months.
Yeah.
They were cleaning up the oil, and it was crazy, man. It was like as far as the eye can see. It was just a sea of black.
Yeah.
And we'd be on the deck, and the little alarm would go off, and we had to go back in the boat, or else the fumes would knock us out.
Oh God.
Yeah, it was incredible.
This book is very candid, very raw at times. You know, you don't pull any punches or don't sort of, you know, if you have something to say about someone, you say it about them. Particularly a lot about your mom and dad. Has your mom read the book? Mm-hmm. And what has her reaction been?
My mom is, she's always been very supportive. Mm-hmm. So she used it as like a tool, honestly. I mean, I spoke to her a lot of the things that some may call criticism of her as a parent. I've talked to her about that. You know, we've gone to therapy together. Yeah.
Did you talk to her about while you were writing the book or?
No,
after
long,
the fact?
Long time before.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've already been through these instances or situations. So it wasn't anything new to her. And she was happy that I was able to tell my story.
Have you spoken to your dad at all?
No.
No. Do you think he will read the book or do you have any idea? Have you gotten any feedback one way or the other?
I would think so. He would read the book. Yeah.
Are you going to let him reach out to you or would you reach out to him at some point?
I don't know. I like to play that by ear. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not really putting too much thought into it.
Yeah. You obviously did a lot of homework for the book in terms of just your father's side of the family, your mother's side of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Grandfather ran a restaurant or bar, this and that. And
yeah.
Were you interviewing either of them or how did you gather all your information?
It was a lot of talking to them. So me and my co-writer, co-author Joshua David Stein, you know, he would spend a lot of time talking to a lot of my friends and family.
Okay.
You know, he spent time with my friend, rest in peace, in the Bronx, and sat with him for a while, a couple days, and really got to know me from the other side of, you know, looking in.
So talk about going to college. You went to college up in Connecticut. You ended up trying to make some money here and there, selling some weed. It then turned into a much more full-blown
operation.
Yeah. Did you ever think you were going to get out of that? Did you ever think you'd be sitting here right now?
No. In the time, I was like, I'm taking this all the way. You know, like I was making a lot of money, and it was the most money I ever seen. It was the only time I was financially independent. I didn't see an end, and it was really seeing President Obama walk across that stage.
Yeah.
For some reason, you know, it really hit me, and it let me know that, you know, there's more to this life out there, and anything that I really wanted to pursue, that I could pursue.
And at that point, you called your mom, said, can I come stay with you in Baton Rouge?
Mm-hmm.
How much of a sense do you think she had of what your life had become since you were, you know, a little kid?
I don't think she knew to the magnitude of where I was at and how I was actually doing. Because, I'm not calling her and telling her, like, hey, I'm going to pick up a half a pound of this. You know, what are you up to? Like, it's not that's not how this conversation generally go. It's like, how you doing? I'm good.
Yeah.
You need anything? No.
No, I'm good. Yeah. How was school? Fine.
It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in that age, that 19-year-old, it's like you know everything.
Yeah.
You know, so it was that. It was coupled with my friends that have been around me since I was a young kid, and they also were kind of concerned at my obsession because I have a very obsessive personality. Like when I get into something, I go all the way. You know, and that's how I was. You know, and yeah, it was good that I got out when I did. Well, maybe now it's legal. So
yeah, well, yeah,
exactly. I would have opened up a dispensary
and
now.
You could have moved to California or Portland or whatever.
Been fine.
And been in the big money.
Notes from a young
entrepreneur.
Yeah.
What's interesting also about the book is that the book starts and ends with your restaurant, Shaw Bijou in D.C., so we're not even at Kith and Kin yet.
Yeah,
this is all before that.
Yeah.
So, it's funny because I remember that I think it's fair to say probably the most controversial restaurant opening in Washington D.C. Just for the listener, we got a ton of heat on the front end. You got a lot of people, as you write about, like, who is this kid thinking he can charge this much, and who is this chef, and yada yada yada.
Yeah.
Going through the process of writing the book, how much of that was therapeutic for you to sort of move beyond what that experience was, or at least sort of process it in a way that at the time you must have been just intense and like frustrated or angry or whatever.
The process is very cathartic, you know, being able to really unravel the story and look at it, you know, because I, in that moment, you know, I wrote, you know, and got it all on the page. And then I had to take a step back, you know, and rewrite and look at it from outside perspective looking in. And I'm very honest, you know, like I understand to a certain extent what they were, you know, talking about. Would I do it again? Hell yeah. Like I still think it was a good restaurant.
Well, you wouldn't. Yet I would say this, not to put words in your mouth, but I was thinking about that. Like if you were to do it again, the obvious question is, what would you do differently? Because there were a lot of factors that came into play, who your partners were and why you were charging $185 because they were short on money and they needed to charge that much. Like, let's say you tell me, what would you do differently?
I would choose my partners differently, for one.
That's hard to do. When you meet someone and they say, hey, we'll give you as much money as you want to start something, like, hell yeah.
But I think vetting your partners is really, really important.
But you know that now, though.
I know that now.
But there's no way you would have known that then.
That's what I would do differently, right?
Yeah, but it's like it's whatever that Bob Dylan song is. If I knew now what I knew then, or whatever, the Birds or whoever saying that. But it's like that's what's so hard because like you had the ambition and the idea, but you obviously had not yet gone through all these experiences that would have taught you how to handle those ideas and ambition.
So like... And it's funny, we're sitting in front of a book with Patrick Clark on the cover. You know, I didn't really have any like older black chefs to call.
Yeah, who could say, all right, if you're going to go into partnership with someone, make sure that ABCD before. Yeah,
I didn't have that. I was like, I always looked up to him. I was like, man, I wish I was coming up in the kitchens around that time. Yeah. You know, I would go work for him or something like that. Like now we have an array of, you know, other young black chefs, you know, who are at the helms of kitchens and own their own kitchens or have worked in the business for a while. But be that as it may, you know, you don't know until you go through these experiences, but these experiences make you. And that's why I said I would do it all over again, because it made me who I am today.
One thing that you did at the end of the book, the restaurant closed after a tumultuous 3-month run for various reasons, a lot having to do with the partners.
It was a pop-up, okay?
Yeah, that's amazing. That's pop-up's a cool word. You could have easily just packed up and left DC.
Yeah.
But you decided not to.
Because that would have been the easy thing to do. I don't think my story was over in DC. I would have always had that what if it would have worked out in DC mentality. And I'm not that kind of person. So I wanted to stay there. I wanted to finish what I started. I also have history in DC. It's not like I'm a passerby, you know. I spent my summers in DC. My grandfather taught at Howard University, you know, in the 70s and...
But did people know that when you opened Bijou, or were people like, I don't think people knew that. New York City chef coming down here telling us how to run a restaurant?
Of course. That's what they said. But also, I'm not just going to jump on and be like, but I belong here. But I did this. It's like the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah, ultimately, is a good restaurant or not?
Exactly. Yeah. None of that stuff matters, you know? But internally, when you're asking me why didn't I just leave, it's because I've been a part of D.C. ever since I can remember. You know, I've always been in D.C.
Yeah.
Back before it was gentrified, when Shaw was a historical, like when Shaw was a black neighborhood.
Yeah. Having grown up in D.C. in the 70s and 80s and going back now and seeing the evolution of the neighborhoods and the city itself, it's, I don't want to say it's unrecognizable, but it's like, wow, this is not the city I grew up in.
It's different. Exactly.
I now go out, I'm like, I want to see stuff. I want to check stuff out. You know? It's like, I feel like I'm visiting like a new city visited before.
Exactly. So yeah, it was hard for me to leave because I never left.
When was the first time post Bijou that you felt, oh, people in DC, the diners, they like me, like they get it, they understand what I'm after now?
Honestly, I always felt that way. I thought that, you know, I got a unfortunate circumstance happen, but people were coming to the Shaw Bijou. There was a time when they weren't coming. Yes. But when we switched the menu over.
Yeah, you said towards the end, you felt like you figured it out.
People were coming, you know, and D.C. supported me ever since I've been there. When the restaurant closed, I would be walking around D.C. and people would be like, hey, Kwame, I'm so sorry. Shaw Bijou closed. Keep your head up. Keep going. Because I went there. It was an amazing experience. Or like, I didn't get a chance to go. I'm pretty sure it was dope. You didn't do anything wrong. You just opened a business. It didn't work out. Like, don't leave.
That happens all the time in the restaurant world.
In business in general.
Yeah.
You know? So there are more businesses that fail than make it. In the microphone production business and like paper cup business, you know, there's more.
In the magazine business.
In the magazine business, exactly.
Knock on wood.
So yeah, you know, I stayed in. I worked it out.
And it's worked out. All right, before we let you go, we're going to do a quick lightning round.
Okay.
Some either or questions.
Okay.
You got to answer.
I like that.
Ready?
Yes.
Gumbo or etouffee?
Gumbo.
Even though etouffee was the dish that won over the ship.
Gumbo won over me.
Nike or Adidas?
Nike.
Got a favorite model?
There's so many good ones. I would say the Jordan 11s.
Oh, I got a pair of golf shoes. They just did a golf shoe version of those.
Oh, the 11s? Yeah, that's awesome.
Really cool. This might be a neither nor one. Deveining shrimp or cleaning an artichoke?
Oof. Cleaning an artichoke. It's so therapeutic. So beautiful.
That eludes me. This refers to your side business, flats or drumettes?
Oh, flats all day.
Really?
Yeah, flats all day.
It's more skill to eat. We're talking about wings here.
Yeah,
to eat the flats, juicier. You got to know what you're doing, though.
Yeah,
to get the meat out.
Yeah, it's you just twist and pop, and then you
well,
can
see,
just,
you know, yeah. you own a wing joint. Yeah, easy for you to say. The worst of it, like my wife's from Buffalo, actually.
Oh, wings. Really?
Yeah, but they don't. She doesn't. A lot of times, I'll look over in the basket, and there's like you know half-eaten wings there.
That's that really upsets me.
I know. Po' boy or cheesesteak?
Oof. Man, that's tough.
These are supposed to be.
That is tough. I'm going to have to go with a cheesesteak.
Because you won't. I was going to say, your Philly wing fry, it's either get a cheesesteak or wings, basically.
Yeah.
A cold brew or espresso?
Espresso. Get it over with.
Any milk in there or just straight up?
Nope, I just shoot it back.
Snooze the alarm or get straight out of bed?
Snooze the alarm. Multiple times.
Late nights. Scrambled or fried?
Scrambled.
Do you do like the French thing where it's all soft and tender and stuff? Mm-hmm. Or?
Yeah. It's delicious.
I agree. Aisle or window seat?
Window. I go to sleep as soon as I sit on a plane.
You can do that?
I can do that. Before we take off, I'll pass out and I'll go lean right on the window and I'm out. I don't need to use the bathroom. Nothing.
You're a lucky man. Nacho cheese Doritos or Hot Cheetos?
Oh,
Cool Ranch. Oh, well, wait. Well, answer the question. Nacho cheese, Cool Ranch, or Hot Cheetos?
Cool Ranch.
Yeah.
No question. The best flavor ever. But I hate ranch dressing.
Oh, really?
But the Cool Ranch Doritos are...
You hate ranch dressing?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Fascinating. A couple more questions and we'll let you roll. Early mornings or late nights?
I'll take both, but if I have to choose late night...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You work in the restaurant industry.
Yeah, I can get up at 4 and
exactly.
At 5. I can do it all. It doesn't matter.
Oh, wait. A couple more. Crawfish or crab?
Crab.
What, any kind of particular?
King crab.
King crab. Why not?
I mean, why the hell? If I get a choice.
Yeah, you get a choice. All right, last question, Kwame. Olive oil or butter?
Butter. 100%.
Kwame Nwachi, thanks for joining us on the Bon Appetit Foodcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.